Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we start with CNN's John King. Malaysia Flight 370, Crimea, Scott Brown, and the Do-Nothing Congress are all on the table. Then State Auditor Suzanne Bump joins us with a controversial idea, giving the auditor the power to audit state tax breaks for big business. In other words, do they work? And then it's a week of mayoral lows and highs. Tom Menino has cancer while his successor both survives the breakfast and plans to keep Boston open later. Another mayor, Ray Flynn, weighs in on it all.
Heard of the five-second rule, as in how long you have to pick up dropped food from the floor? Stay tuned to big breaking news on the five-second front. Then Globe sports writer Shira Springer on the rise of the Paralympics. Why the rise? Because thousands of young American soldiers have lost limbs to war. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So for someone known to take on big banks, Senator Elizabeth Warren is also making a name for herself as the, I don't know, Daddy Warbucks of the Democratic Party. But despite her fundraising powers, could the Democrats lose the Senate to the Republicans in November? Joining us to take on these and other headlines out of the nation's capital is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John is also the host of CNN's Great News Sunday morning show, Inside Politics. Hey there, John.
Happy Tuesday. How are you guys?
We
are
you.
Great, John. Great to talk to you. So, John, the ratings of CNN have gone absolutely through the roof with the cover of covering the tragic story of this Malaysian Flight 370. Just want to make sure that we are allowed to talk to you about politics today. We don't have to just talk about the plane. Is that correct?
We can talk about whatever you guys want to talk about, as long as you know, working a little spring training.
Well, absolutely working a little spring training. But back to the plane for just 1 minute. You have done just transfixing coverage of this tragedy. Is there anything new that our listeners should know about this morning that you guys have picked up?
The latest thing this morning is, number one, there's a New York Times report I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, that the changes in the flight were done through the computer, which I guess in some ways is kind of obvious because planes are so full of my computers nowadays. But it leads you again to the idea that, a pilot or a co-pilot or somebody with highly sophisticated knowledge of how this 777 worked, programmed in the changes. And the other thing that we're chasing is, Thailand says that it picked up something on its radar that could well have been this flight not long after the last communication. And they're trying to crunch the radar data now. But look, we've been through this now for going on 2 weeks. Every day there seems to be this new piece of information where you say, aha, finally they're going to connect the dots and ultimately, circle a place on a map and find a debris field somewhere. And then the next day we seem to be back at square one. I think that's the greatest frustration here and then the mystery. And, I think that's also what's driving the news interest. I mean, obviously, there's a tragedy most likely involving these, 300 or so families. But then the idea is we can go on our iPad or our laptop and find my iPhone with a little app and we can't find a 777. I think that, in today's technology age, that's a giant frustration to people, but also, forgive me, it's probably most likely incredibly sad and tragic, but it's a fascinating mystery.
Well, one of the most chilling details I've heard in the last day or so is that all right, good night were the final words from the cockpit, and it just gives you the chills to even think about it. Anyway,
we're in the post 9/11 world, so your first thing is it terrorism, then is it a hijacking, then. We've had other cases in the past of, pilot or crew suicide. Is it mechanical? Was there an electrical fire? And each and every one of these, when you're absent information, are, plausible scenarios, but that's all they are at the moment, are scenarios.
Let's move to another part of the world, John King. Vladimir Putin essentially takes Crimea after this sketchy referendum vote, 97% allegedly voting to secede and move into Russia. Yesterday morning, the President of the United States lists some new sanctions. The response from the Deputy Prime Minister of Russia is literally to laugh at them. What does the United States do here in addition to the kinds of measures that both Obama, Biden, and I guess our allies in Western Europe and Eastern Europe are talking about?
I think, sadly, the answer is not much, in the sense that there's not much at the president's disposal. The sanctions he outlined yesterday are pretty modest, and as you noted, all of the Russian officials involved kind of mocking them. President Putin today said in his speech that we have no fear of your sanctions, essentially laughing at the President of the United States and at the West. The U.S. sanctions are modest. The European sanctions are even more modest, and that's backwards if you're trying to get a solution, because it's the Europeans that have the day-to-day, week-to-week, big money, economic and financial relationships with Russia, particularly over energy. And there's an unwillingness among the 20-plus, nearly 30 members of the European alliances to do much more right now because of the potential economic impact on them. You want to deliver an economic impact and a blow to Putin, but they're worried about the ripple effect on them. And so at the moment, you see no evidence that Putin's going to blink. And I think it's important, we tend to think of these things from our own political bearings. And so you think, okay, so we're going to shame him on the world stage. We're going to isolate him diplomatically. We're going to punish him financially. And that will impact him and make him say, okay, I made a mistake and pull back. Well, that's our logic. It's not his logic. This is a nationalist who's been took a piece of Georgia, has been looking for a chance to take more territory and sort of, pound his chest a little bit. And he's a politician like everybody else involved here back home right now. He seems to be benefiting from this. So I see no sign he's ready to blink.
I have to say, I don't get this at all. I'm not saying whether I just don't get it. This comes just weeks, and I'm sure we've had this discussion with you, John, comes weeks after he spends $50+ billion to basically make himself one of the leading citizens of the world. And then he does this, gets dumped from the G8, which apparently was an important symbol of pride for him to belong to the G8. He's now in this incredibly tough situation. Crimea is an economic disaster, had been depending on Kiev. Now it depends on Russia, which also has its economic problems. What's the agenda? I forget the solution. What is the agenda on the part of Putin? Just to flex his bare muscles?
It seems to be power. Yes, it does seem to be power. And, he has long talked about, Russia returning to its rightful place in his view in the world. And this seems to be a power and an ego trip.
Well, let me ask you about the politics of this, John. Mitt Romney, of course, who ran for president against Barack Obama, has written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal blaming both Obama and Hillary Clinton for this whole mess over there, and said that, since Obama got elected, the respect of leaders around the world and countries around the world has gone down, not up. And he says, we haven't done anything good, and this whole Crimean mess is Obama's fault. Now, of course, there's some partisan politics here, but is Romney right in the center of Republican thought? Is that basically the story, that it's Obama's fault from their perspective?
From their perspective, you hear that from a lot of Republicans. I would just say, remember, for the people who say that, and there's, we can talk about some of the things the president has done and how they could have factored into this, but remember, when Putin did take a piece of Georgia, that was in the George W. Bush presidency, and you did not see the parade of Republicans saying, it's because Bush is weak, it's because Bush vacillated, it's because Bush, naively said all these things around the world and people took advantage of him. So you need to filter it through the historical context. However, Governor Romney, during the campaign, remember, did say that he viewed Putin as a huge geopolitical threat.
Right,
and he was mocked. He was mocked by Obama. He was mocked by a lot of commentators who thought that he was looking in the wrong place in the world. At one point in one of the debates, President Obama turned to Governor Romney and said, hey, Governor, the 80s called. They want their foreign policy back. He was scornful about it. And so, Governor Romney has some standing to say, I told you so, I guess. My view on these things is, most time spent looking in the rearview mirror is wasted time. What are you going to do going forward? And there are people, and this is a legitimate, source of conversation. Some of the criticism is partisan reflex. There are some who say, because the president drew a red line in Syria and then didn't enforce it, and then after a second red line came to the verge of enforcing it and then backed off, that he does look weak, or he looks unwilling, if weak might be the wrong word, but that there's nobody around the world who thinks that Barack Obama is ready and willing to use strong U.S. military force. Yes, he'll use drones. Yes, he'll help out in something like Libya. But he's not willing to do something on the scale of an Iraq or an Afghanistan. And if he's unwilling to do that, then if you're willing to take financial sanctions and tough words, then I guess you can take Crimea.
Okay, from Kuala Lumpur to Crimea to Nashua, New Hampshire. I have to say, once again, proving that my streak is intact of making every political prediction wrong. I was convinced Scott Brown was going to run until the poll came out from David Paleologos at Suffolk University, showing him 13 points down, immediately after which Scott Brown formed an exploratory committee. He's obviously running against Jean Shaheen. As somebody who knows these things better than anybody, 13 points is not an insurmountable thing for Scott Brown. Is it or is it?
It's not insurmountable, not in the least. We're talking in the middle of March, and the election is in November. He would have to win a Republican primary first, and there's some sour grapes up there, some hard feelings that they think he's flirted with them too long and waited too long. But again, that's the activist community. That's not the voters for the most part. So there's plenty of time to make this up. I would say this, as someone who spent a lot of time reporting on this, even when I was getting indications that he was about to run and saying that on television, I was saying in the next breath, but a whole lot of people don't believe him because of this flirtation. There are still some people in New Hampshire, because he announced an exploratory committee, not a full campaign committee, that he's going to go around the state for a few weeks, and he's on like day six now, I guess, of his tour or something like that, that he's going to go around the state for a few weeks, and if those polls don't move, then he's going to bow out. I think that would hurt him if he did that. I think it would hurt his standing in the Republican Party, and I think it would really potentially hurt his potential to run again. Maybe he'd have to move somewhere else. But
but look, I think he's running out of options on that front.
But remember this. Remember this. It's fun to make fun of politicians, and he did sort of open himself up to this by flirting for a long time. But you guys remember this from the Massachusetts race. He is a very good campaigner. He's a very good retail politician.
Yep.
He's very good at the things that New Hampshire is known for. And so 13 points in a year when the president's in around 41-42% nationally, Obamacare is not faring too well, people don't think the economy's doing too well. Now Senator, former Governor Shaheen, she's not a dynamo per se as a communicator, but she's a proven successful politician in her state. So if Scott Brown gets in and he wins the Republican primary, I think that will be a great race between two heavyweights.
We're talking to CNN's John King. I want to stay on Brown for a second, but before we get back to him in particular, you said, some are saying he may explore and decide, even though it's a long shot, that he's not going to do this. Is there any major candidate you can think of who put together an exploratory committee and then decided not to run? I'm trying to think. I can't think of one. Can you?
Yeah, I think there have been some, like in the early stages of a presidential race where they never officially transferred over. But in something like this, again, as somebody who knows, he understands. I mean, we're cracking jokes here about it, but he understands that, his credibility is at stake here. We talked in the past, last time we talked about this, I think I said how, I was hearing from people that, Gail was asking him a lot of tough questions, but she wanted to make sure that if he was going to do this because of what it does to her life and the family's life, that he is serious about it. So he's gotten in now. He mentioned her in his speech announcing the committee. So I assume that they've gone, as partners and as a family, they've gone through all this and that he's in. Look, if nothing else, let's see what Scott Brown does. I mean, he's been wrestling with this idea because he also thinks in the back of his head he might want to run for president. And that's all fine and good, too. I just can't see him winning the Republican presidential nomination with his views. Give me some evidence in my lifetime that somebody with his views on the issues can win the Republican presidential nomination. So I assume he's going to run for the Senate now and try to raise his profile. But if nothing else, this expands the map, and this is why the Republicans have an even greater chance of taking back the Senate. Because a month or two ago, we'd be talking about 9 or 10 Democratic-held seats on the target list. Now we're talking about 12 or 14, and the Republicans need 6. So the simple math tells you they've got more opportunities to get the 6 they need now that Scott Brown is most likely in.
Well, that is all the big talk, John King from CNN, that the Democrats may lose the Senate. Your colleague on MSNBC, Chris Matthews, is fretted about this, and there seems to be a panic mood. So that would sort of lend more credence to Scott Brown hanging in there.
It would lend more credence to hanging in there. Look, the president's health care plan is not popular in New Hampshire. You've got a good giant pool of independent voters who are, sort of Scott Brown's wheelhouse, if you will. Now, Governor Shaheen has done well with them in the past, so you'll have a good fight and competition for them. But in a year where the Republicans think they can get the Senate back, if we get into the summertime and Scott Brown first survives that primary and then is viewed as in contention, one of the things he will not suffer for is resources. because Republicans will be looking around the map, and whether it's, you know, the party organizations, the super PACs. I know that a lot of the people, some of the people talking to him, trying to encourage him to run with the business community and the Chamber of Commerce types, where we've seen them already in some of these other states getting involved in Republican primaries and spending some money. They were very active down in Florida 13, that House special election, helping David Jolly win that race down there. And so he's been looking around and seeing what's happening. And, you know, it takes guts to get into a race. And we've been making fun of him a little bit. We should in some ways applaud him. It takes guts to get into a race when you're looking at a poll that says you're 13 down against somebody who is formidable, like, you know, Senator Shaheen. But if he is in contention in that race, he will not suffer for lack of resources because the Republicans want to stretch the map as much as they can. And, you know, just in the last 2 weeks, they've added New Hampshire and Colorado to their, I call them the flashing light targets, the states they think they might be able to get.
You know, the two names, at least in this state, that come up every time one mentions Scott Brown are Martha Coakley. She was in the studio with us yesterday. Obviously, she's leading candidate for governor right now, likely to run against Charlie Baker if she wins the nomination. The other one's Elizabeth Warren. What I've been reading the last few days, John, which is, I guess, not a surprise if you stay up with these stories, is Elizabeth Warren, maybe not quite, but is coming close to replacing Ted Kennedy as the dynamo who goes around the country, the liberal dynamo who raises money for Democrats in these contests. How big is she beyond our borders?
We're about to find out. She's a big name. You know, I remember when I first came to Washington, here will be the true test. You know, it has been a while, but you know, you're right. For years, the senior senator from Massachusetts, who was then Ted Kennedy, was not only a giant fundraising dynamo for the Democrats, but for the Republicans,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the Democrats used to write letters about Jesse Helms, and the Republicans used to write letters about Ted Kennedy. you know, and that's how they raised money, like, oh, God, we got look who's on the other side. We have to raise money. Elizabeth Warren's not quite at that point yet among Republicans, but if she has a successful fundraising season this year, and she's, you know, she's going out to the Midwest to help Al Franken, she's going out, I think, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, and she says it's got nothing to do with running for president, and I think we all take her at her word that especially if Hillary runs, she's not running. And maybe even if Hillary doesn't run, she won't run now. But she is a national figure in the Democratic Party without a doubt, especially with the more liberal populist streak in the party. And that's one of the, you know, if you're talking about an issues environment this year that talks about, you know, being against big money, being against the Koch brothers, being for raising the minimum wage, she fits that profile. So, and she can help candidates not only raise a lot of money, but get a lot of media attention when she comes through town.
Hey, John, when you were a mere local type up here working for the Associated Press, whatever you're doing, did you ever go to the St. Patrick's Day breakfast?
Amen, my friend.
Yeah, it was probably pretty good in John's
mean, amen?
Day. Were you there? Were you there when Bulger was the
Bulger and Weld,
Major
Billy,
D.
Billy was, yeah. Billy and Governor Weld was
yeah.
around in those days.
Well,
and,
you saw.
I was around in the Ed King days, and good jobs at good wages. Remember that guy?
Oh, we do indeed.
That's
we
right.
do indeed. Hey, the reason I ask you that is because we wanted to get into what Congress does the rest of the year, and we figured the way to get into it was to play something Congressman Steve Lynch from South Boston had to say the other day at the breakfast. Here's Lynch.
Marijuana is in the news a lot lately, but I just want to say one thing to Charlie Baker. You never have to worry about the Republicans in Congress smoking pot. Because that would actually require them to pass something.
Pretty good line by Steve Lynch. I know we discuss this all the time, and I know we sound like naive rubes up here in Boston, Massachusetts. Are they done for the? Is this other than small stuff? Is this do nothing Congress going to continue to do nothing through January, or at least through November?
I think they'll probably come together on some sort of a Ukraine economic aid package. I think they'll pass a status quo budget that essentially just keeps spending levels where they are and, you know, kicks any tough choices like Medicare, like Social Security, even like, you know, big dramatic military reforms, depending on, you know, which side of the budget debate you find yourself on and what Washington should do. I see zero evidence they're going to do anything except the status quo stuff they have to do. Because remember, they haven't worked very hard recently anyway. And this year, they want to get out as soon as possible to get home. Self-preservation, that is goal number one this year, not governing.
Am I allowed one more naive question today, or have I used up my naive quotient, John King? Be kind, will you?
Fire away.
One. Did I ever sit down, either in your presence or not, off the record, John Boehner or Eric Cantor or Harry Reid or somebody, and say in private sessions, gripe sessions, you know, even though we're going to get reelected in landslides, most of I and virtually all of my colleagues, This is a little embarrassing that there's so many huge issues from immigration on down that the American people gun reform want us to do, and we've done nothing. Or is that as naive as I guess it probably is? Do they have those conversations?
No, it's actually not naive at all. I would never disclose a private conversation I had with anybody, but I can say this, whether they be a Democrat or Republican, but I can say this. I know from numerous conversations with people who know, for example, on immigration, Speaker Boehner genuinely wanted to do it. He wanted to do it, and he came close to doing it, and then he had a revolt from his own members, not just the conservatives, who say that, you know, even a path just to legal status, in their view, is amnesty. They weren't the only ones complaining. A lot of his loyalists who would vote for, if he brought it to the floor, they would have voted for it. But they said, Mr. Speaker, or they call him John because they're friends, you know, the primary deadline hasn't passed in my state yet. If I vote for that bill, I'm going to get a Tea Party challenge. I can't do that. You know, don't make me do that. And they would have done it if he brought it to the floor, but he backed off because he was looking around thinking he was going to lose 8 or 10 of his friends to primary challenges. On the Democratic side, it's a little bit more complicated because you have Harry Reid now. You know, look at the president's nominee for Surgeon General. Dr. Murthy is his name. Now, some people say he's not qualified to be Surgeon General, but his main crime right now is that he supports the president of the United States in pushing for greater background checks and some gun control. Now, that's not going to happen. They're not going to vote to make that happen, but they won't even vote to confirm him. And Harry Reid is telling the White House, I don't want to bring him up for a vote, not because the Republicans are going to vote no, but because Harry Reid doesn't want to make, you know, Mark Pryor of Arkansas, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Mark Begich of Alaska, Kay Hagan of North Carolina, states with strong gun rights positions. The NRA opposes this guy, and they say they will score the vote and they will punish anybody who votes for him. So Harry Reid won't even bring the nomination to the floor because he's afraid it'll hurt his members. And so politics rules the day. Do they want to get stuff done? Sure. Or are they willing to make the tough choices and potentially lose to get things done? That's the part. That's where you get the push comes to shove. And the answer to that is no.
John King from CNN, one more question for me. I just wonder, we had Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul, finishing first back at CPAC, the big conservative powwow. And then he just finished first again, not nearly as significantly. He was close to Chris Christie at this another conservative meeting up in New Hampshire. It's obviously really early, but what do we make of this? We always tell the story about being up in New Hampshire for the last two presidential contests, actually, when there were crowds and crowds of young, almost all men, almost all young, but who were just kneeling at the altar of Rand Paul's father, Ron. Rand obviously is the guy of the hour now. How real is this Rand Paul apparent surge, at least early on?
He's also ahead in our new CNN poll of Republican voters about who their choice for the nominee is. Now, just barely, he gets 16%. Paul Ryan gets 15%. And another guy to watch is the rebounding, give me a second chance, Rick Perry, governor of Texas, was third in our poll. But how real is Rand Paul? I will say this. To me, he's the most fascinating story in American politics today. And not because I'm saying I agree with anything. That's not my job. My job is to watch them, not to agree or disagree with them. But look what he's trying to do. He's trying to take his dad's libertarian base, which, you know, from the past campaign is a good slice. It's not enough to win.
Yep.
It's not enough to win, but they have the Iowa Republican Party wired, the Ron Paul people. They have a lot of people in New Hampshire where the libertarian streak is part of that state's great tradition. So he's trying to take that, then his little piece of the Tea Party, and he's trying to trap Ted Cruz, too. Say, Ted Cruz, all you are is a Tea Party guy. I'm libertarian. I've got a little bit of Tea Party. But Rand Paul is an ophthalmologist who lives on a country club in Kentucky who's supporting Mitch McConnell. He's not running away from the Republican establishment. In fact, he's courting Mitt Romney donors, trying to say, I can be with the establishment, too, and pick up those voters. He'll go after social conservatives. He'll go after independents, and he's going after young people as well. And he's even, this week, he's out at Berkeley, you know, that noted conservative bastion, the University of Berkeley, California at Berkeley. He is trying to, I call him Patchwork Paul or Cobblestone Paul. He's trying to put together these little pieces, you know, 3% here, 10% there, 4% there. And look, we make politics complicated sometimes, but it's actually very simple. It's about addition and subtraction. And if he can take these little pieces and put together this coalition and hold it together in a crowded Republican field in 2016, the guy's going to do some business. Because he can go from state to state and have, you know, maybe there aren't as many social conservatives in New Hampshire, but there are more libertarians and there's some college kids. Then you go on to South Carolina, you need more of the Tea Party. If he can put this piece together, and eventually people think it's going to combust and explode, But if he can pull it off, he will be a force to be reckoned with.
Okay, putting little pieces together. I'm speaking to you as Dorchester's John King. Forget this CNN thing. John Farrell just called, and he has to make the decision today. Is it Sizemore or Bradley in center field, John King?
I think it'll be Sizemore.
Should it be?
At the beginning of the season, maybe. The question here is, and I don't know, I don't know Jackie Bradley. He's a young guy who came up last year. He was the rising star, and then he needed to go to the minor leagues. He wasn't quite ready. I don't understand him. Some young players, have a psyche issue. And if he's fragile and you think it's going to hurt him, then maybe you play him first and the veteran guy can come off the bench if he stumbles. If you come out of spring training and you think Sizemore's your better player right now and you have a tough early schedule, hello Baltimore, hello New York Yankees, better teams early on the schedule this year, then you probably want to get your veteran guy in there early on. Or you look in the camera and say, you know what? We didn't settle this competition in spring training. So we're going to play him 50-50 during the year, and I'm going to play the hot hand. He did that a bit last year, remember, with Johnny Gomes and the like, and just say, hey, everybody's important on this team, and we're going to play the hot hand, maybe do it that way. Maybe you don't have to make a choice here.
I have to disclose, as I always do, that I'm a Philly boy by origin, but when I saw a diving catch in left center field by Grady Sizemore 2 days ago, my decision was made. Hey, John King, it's great to talk to you, as always. CNN's John King, thanks so much for your time.
Take care, guys.
You too, John. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent and host, as Jim said, of the Sunday morning show, Inside Politics, on every Sunday at 8:30 in the morning. Up next, when it comes to business getting billions of dollars in tax breaks, should there be a watchdog? State Auditor Suzanne Bump certainly thinks so, and guess who she thinks the overseer should be? We'll tell you next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Baker Library Bloomberg Center at Harvard Business School, now exhibiting the art of American advertising with ads, trade cards, and catalogs from the dawn of modern advertising. Info at library.hbs.edu. And Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, with over 100 master technicians on staff, offering brand name tires and parts, committed to serving New England for over 59 years. Information and locations at SullivanTire.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is what I would call one of the luckiest women in the Commonwealth. State Auditor Suzanne Bump was spared her moment in the spotlight at Sunday St. Patrick's Day breakfast because of what I will call, how should I call it, the gas baggery of her colleagues. Will her luck continue through tomorrow, she's laughing, by the way, with her push for legislation to give the auditor power to audit business tax break? Auditor Bump, it's good to see you.
Yes, it is.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, before we get to your audit proposals, I mean, this is an opportunity. You didn't get to use your great material on St. Patrick's Day. Would you like to give us a joke or two here, Auditor Suzanne Bump?
No, I can't use the routine because it actually had visuals that went with it. So,
were you upset or relieved?
I'd be
tell the truth.
All that work. A little bit of both.
I think, okay.
All that work, nothing.
That's why. Well, that and the fact that my husband was in Florida, he could have been there with him. But for the commitment to the breakfast. Yes, that's true. See, that's the level of dedication that I bring to
the
job.
Yeah, but at least the corned beef hash was horrible. Would you agree with that?
I didn't eat anything.
Oh, that's horrible.
She's too nervous about getting ready for her performance.
No, it's because I can't leave the house without having breakfast first.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, two breakfasts.
All right. You're one of those breakfast is the most important meal types. Is that your deal?
Absolutely. And the cup of tea that goes with it.
Oh, okay.
Now, Suzanne Bump, you have filed legislation that is near and dear to my heart. I'll explain in a couple of minutes. And the critical moment is tomorrow when bills have to be reported out. Tell people who haven't been reading what power are you trying to gain and why?
Well, I'm trying to gain the power that 36 other auditors have to be able to audit the Department of Revenue and determine how well they are doing at auditing business tax breaks. There are 43 states where businesses have to file a tax return. In 36 of those states, auditors specifically have the ability to look at the tax returns, because that's what you have to do. You have to look at the underlying data when you're auditing. You don't just ask an agency, what do you do, and then take it at face value. You have to be able to test what they say they do. So when they say we use these criteria to determine when we're going to audit a business tax break, we have to be able to see if they are doing what they're saying they're doing. The only way we can know that is if we look at the tax returns ourselves. Under Massachusetts law, I'm prohibited from doing that. So I can't determine how well the Department of Revenue is doing its job of staying on top of the more than $2 billion worth of business tax breaks, which is, you know, frankly, it's foregone revenue for the Commonwealth.
Well, you hear about this all the time, where companies like down in Downtown Crossing get big tax breaks from the Menino administration to come into Downtown Crossing. Or years ago, Raytheon got big tax breaks with this promise that they were going to keep all these jobs in Massachusetts. And then they absconded. Where'd they go? Rhode Island or something like that? I mean, they didn't do that. So that's the thing. It seems like we are sometimes getting ripped off by promises not kept.
We could well be. And unfortunately, there is no independent objective analyst to determine whether that is happening or not, because the auditor's office is the independent objective analyst, and I don't have the power to get to the source data, the tax returns.
You know, the incredible business community, according to Steve Sire in a piece he wrote in the Boston Globe a couple of days ago, is up in arms over this privacy, right? A whole variety, kind of anti-competitive, all this sort of thing. The incredible thing to me, as a former lobbyist, and I use the term loosely, I actually used to be there when you were a lowly state rep many years ago, or a state rep, pardon me, many years ago,
really?
Suzanne Buff.
I appreciate that characterization.
But in all seriousness, every single dollar the state spends, particularly on poor people, is scrutinized. If one woman misuses her EBT card, we practically call out the National Guard. Every dollar, as you know, has to be reappropriated every single year. That's the way governments work. But if a tax break is passed that benefits a set of businesses, essentially it is written in stone forever, and there is no vehicle to find out if what the sponsor said, which is, if we do this tax break, we're going to create 23,000 jobs in Massachusetts. All you're saying, I think, is let me have a vehicle to find out if the promises being made are being met. Isn't that all it is?
You've absolutely summed it up beautifully. And in fact, using the Department of Transitional Assistance is a very good analogy. And it's one that I have made when I've been talking about this. We went into the Department of Transitional Assistance to see how well it was doing its job of screening applicants for public assistance to make sure they were deserving, and then to see if the agency was using all of its fraud detection tools. They told us how they did business. We said, okay, that's great. Now let us look at the records to see that that's how you do business. And what did we find? We found that they weren't checking Social Security numbers. And so we had people receiving benefits that were using the Social Security number of a dead person. And we also saw that the agency literally did not know how to make use of the monthly reports that its own computer system churned out that could help them identify patterns of abuse of those benefits. And the only reason we were able to find that out is that we were able to look at applications. So the analogy is perfect. The only way we can find out whether the Department of Revenue is doing its job is to look at the underlying data, the business tax returns. And mind you, we are not talking about auditing those companies ourselves. This is information we want to gather to see how well DOR is doing, and then what we can determine about who in broad categories are the beneficiaries of these various tax returns.
So what these business groups are lobbying against this. If sodium pentothal was injected into any of their leaders, and they had to say why they're really, what's the deal here? I mean, what's the argument?
Well, what people have said to me off the record is we just don't want our members to become embarrassed. Well, and they raise beer privacy concerns. The reality is
embarrassed by what? Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Embarrassed by what?
I guess by findings that these tax breaks are just a boon and there is no public benefit. Potentially, I don't know. You know, the thing can go the other way. We could find that the DOR is being, you know, overly burdensome in its regulation. But I think that you know, there, as I said, 36 states already have this power invested in the state auditor. Just a few months ago, for instance, Tennessee went to its Department of Revenue and said, "Hey guys, we can't tell whether you have granted these tax breaks that were specifically tied to dollar investments in the businesses and the hiring of a certain number of employees." The auditor in Tennessee said, there's no evidence that you're doing this right, that they are actually deserving. Massachusetts taxpayers deserve the same level of assurance that the tax programs have integrity as they do that the welfare programs have integrity. Okay. That's what this is about.
We're talking with State Auditor Suzanne Bump, who's filed legislation that she hopes will enable her to look into corporations' tax returns to make sure that the tax breaks they're getting are being used in the correct way. You know, Jim brought up, Auditor Bump, the fact that he knew you up at the State House when you were a lowly, as he put it, state representative.
I meant that in a loving way.
And he was a swashbuckling lobbyist, you know, running roughshod through the halls of Beacon Hill. But you did tell, and you should share with the listeners, when you were doing some corporate tax disclosure work
since
you have a great story about the former Senate President, Billy Bulger, which I think—
If you'll bear with me for a second. Had left the legislature at the end of this thing. I used to do ballot campaigns for a living, as Suzanne knows. Right. We filed a question called corporate tax reporting disclosure, which would have required every publicly traded corporation, bank, an insurance company disclose what they paid in taxes and whether they were creating jobs. It's a variation, more expansive than you're doing, but a variation on a theme. Well, we collected 120,000 signatures. We had the thing on the ballot for 1992, I believe. And Paul Tsongas came back from running for president, was up in arms, pulled together, I'm giving the short version, every leader in Massachusetts, from Bill Weld to Joe Kennedy to everybody in between, Speaker of the House, Senate President. Charlie Flaherty was the Speaker. The Senate President was Bill Bulger. We met in Bill Weld's office. And ultimately, the short version is we settled the question. We got about 80% of what we wanted, but some of business's major concerns were addressed. Well, here's the part that I only told after the statute of limitations ran. Before I agreed to the deal, I meet in the chief of staff of the governor's office with Charlie Flaherty, Speaker of the House, and Bill Bulger. And I said, gentlemen, here's the deal. First with Flaherty. I want to know, and Flaherty had been a sponsor of this when this was just a bill in the legislature.
Yeah, he used to chair taxation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then when he's Speaker, he still supported this thing. I said, I want to know that when this thing passes, because I think it's going to be like a bombshell on Beacon Hill, that you will not entertain an effort to repeal it for a year. So it has a chance to work. Charlie Flaherty said, no problem. Bill Bulger comes in. I'm alone with Bill Bulger and one lobbyist. And I said, Mr. President, same thing. I want a commitment from you that you will not repeal this for 1 year. And Bulger looks at me and he said, James, as he used to call me, he said, James, let me understand what you're trying to say to me. You are saying that you want me to violate all the rules of procedure of the Senate so that you can have a year for this bill of yours, should it pass, should we agree to this? Is that what you're saying, James? And I said, well, I wouldn't put it that way, Mr. President, but the answer is yes. He says, done. Okay, so the deal is it passes. Here's what happens, almost the end of the story. Goes into effect a year and a half later. Page one of the Boston Globe, January 1st of 1994, thousands of corporations pay nothing in taxes. Day two, Corporation X, and I just can't remember the name, takes millions in tax breaks, exports jobs to North Carolina. A bombshell. So what does the legislature decide to do rather than changing the tax laws? You had left the year before. They decided to repeal the law because obviously business doesn't like it. Charlie Flaherty, who said he'd wait a year, will not see me. They repeal it. It goes over to the Senate. Here's the end of the story. And I stop Bill Bulger in the hall and I say, Mr. President, can I come meet with you? Because of course, James, I want to meet with you. So here's the short version. The day of that it's scheduled, I go in, as he says, come in and see me first thing in the morning, 9 o'clock. I go in there at 9 o'clock. His chief of staff says, the Senate president really wants to see you. Sit in his office. Wait for him, please. I wait in his regal office. 10 minutes goes by. An hour goes by. I said to the chief of staff, when's he come? Well, he'll be here to sit. Finally, about 2 hours later, I say, I'm not staying here anymore. I go out in the hall. A lobbyist who's part of my team says, where in the have you been? I said, I'm waiting for the Senate president. Waiting for the Senate president. He was in the at the rostrum gaveling through repeal of corporate tax disclosure while you're sitting in it. So I'm sorry to ramble on for a long
time. True. That no, has to be
no,
a
it was actually
no.
It was worse than
fiction.
That. But exactly.
Oh my
but in
God.
Essence, you know,
he was fooled is the
bottom
basic line.
Message. Fooled. It seems to me, I mean, our basic notion, Suzanne Bump, was sunshine was the best disinfectant. And as you said, if you should treat expenditures through the tax system, which cost the taxpayer money, just like you said before, exactly like public spending. So what kind of, they're all Democrats on Beacon Hill. You're a Democrat. What do they say to you? What do the chairs of the committee say to you when you say, this is all I'm looking for is information? You don't have any power to repeal the tax breaks. All you want is information. What do they say to you?
They say this is a very interesting idea, and there are varying levels of interest in it. But whether it's going to make it out of committee, I just don't know. You know, the business community says, "Oh, well, this information could be leaked or used inappropriately." Look, this is we're not the first people to get access to tax returns. There are already 26 other exemptions on the books. We already get, in my office, access to individuals' tax returns so that we can investigate public assistance fraud, again, welfare fraud. And there are, as I said, 26 already. This is a law that has criminal penalties if I were to go out and start, you know, naming names or disclosing proprietary information. But Jim, you know, I mean, this has been a tough several years of recession and post-recession, slow economic growth. When the business community says, oh, this could be a job killer, oh, this will discourage people from coming here, it causes people to quake. And so, therefore, I think that there's intellectually a lot of receptivity to it, but reluctance to upset the apple cart. I'll tell you something else, though. Every individual businessman who has read about this, because it has been reported on and opined on by various media outlets, has said to me, to a person, Suzanne, what's the matter with these guys? Of course, this makes all the sense in the world. But you get to the business, you know, the trade associations, and they feel like they've got to protect their members, whereas their individual members were saying, well, yeah, you know, because partly is not everybody gets to take advantage of all of these breaks. Some people, you know, don't qualify for them. And they're saying, well, why are we supporting that industry? How about supporting my industry? Well, so they realize it's not equitable.
Look at the people that are lined up against you, State Auditor Suzanne Bump. You've got the heads of the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, the Massachusetts Business Roundtable, the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation. That's not the half of it, I'm sure. That's taken from Steve Sire's story in the Globe. So these people,
and
I would
Bilger, imagine. You forgot Bill.
Bill Bilger, that's right, wherever he is now over in South Boston. And these people have lobbyists. They have a lot of the expense accounts and, you know, dinners and golfing and all these other things. I mean, I think that they have the ability to seduce more members than maybe the people down at the welfare department have. You know what I'm saying?
Is anybody supporting this besides you? Is anybody lobbying for this thing?
Well, I mean, it has the support of some other organizations. MassPerg, I think your successor organization, the successor to Team, I think the Mass
Budget and Policy Center, yeah.
they're interested in it. You know, but the reality is they have their own agenda. They have their own legislative priorities. But this happens to be mine. And so I appreciate opportunities like this where I get to tell the public about the fact that we have this gaping hole in terms of accountability. It, as you say, these tax breaks go into a black box. Nobody ever opens the box to see if they're working. And yet we demand accountability in every other area of government.
Yeah,
why
also,
not tax policy?
I want to underline one other thing you said, Suzanne Bump, before. These are called tax breaks, which is what all of us call it, tax expenditures is the term of art. And what this means, you said there are $2 billion of them. Let's assume you find that $1.9 billion perfectly meritorious, but $100 million aren't and they should be repealed. People say, what does that have to do with me? Well, the businesses that take that $100 million would otherwise be paying $100 million to the state, which
money.
Means you either have $100 million more to spend on things you care about, or you tax real people $100 million less. So it's right. not an abstract concept. It is the ultimate concept in information equity, and it's right. just... it's really,
so
it drives me nuts. Yeah, what's the number of the bill?
If people are upset about this, they should call the State House, 617-722-2000, or they should email their legislators or state senators or state representatives. What is the number of the bill?
So there are actually two bills. My bill is House 7, and it is before the Revenue Committee. There is another bill that Representative Jay Kaufman, who chairs the Revenue Committee, filed. That is, I believe, 2843. His is identical to mine. For some reason, his went to a different committee. It went to the Committee on State Administration. So there are, in fact, two vehicles to advance this idea.
So if the House chair supports you, does that mean the Senate chair doesn't support you?
I'm...
Who is the Senate Chair of the Revenue? I know, I'm sorry, but you brought it up, not me.
Okay, so,
who's the Senate Chair of the Revenue Committee?
Senator Mike Rodriguez.
Okay.
And on the state administration side, it's Representative Peter Cocott and Senator Ken Donnelly. There's varying levels of interest, or nobody has said to me no.
Understood. But
yeah.
Tamar, just nobody so people understand, just like we were discussing, who were discussing the cap on
charter schools
with the other
Deval
day.
Deval Patrick,
right? I remember
governor.
Him. The governor.
Yeah.
And the deadline for these bills to be reported out is tomorrow.
Yes.
So if anybody cares, and frankly, even if you don't like Suzanne Bum's proposal and you want to weigh in small d democratic way, it's 722-2000. The two bills, as she said, are House 7, H7, and House 2843. Let yourself be heard on an issue that I think, again, the end of the day, as you said, they all may be doing what they're supposed to do, in which case you at least know that your money is well spent.
But that's the important point. I mean, there's a lot of money not going back to cities and towns this year because the economy is not great,
yep.
So it affects how many teachers you have in your classroom, how many cops, firefighters, all these
right.
things. So you want to make sure it's fair if these corporations that don't deserve it and are going to take their jobs elsewhere anyway
right.
are getting these huge tax breaks. I mean, it impacts yeah. your real estate taxes your classroom.
You're absolutely right. You know, in some of these tax breaks, they have deductions, they're exemptions, they're incentives. Some of them are for purposes other than job creation. They could be for the use of clean technologies,
right.
You know, alternative energy systems and the like. And so it's all about accountability. Is there a public benefit to the
Amen.
Private benefit? That's the point.
Last thing I know a lot of listeners are going to want to know, is your food taster on the state budget or do you pay out of your campaign fund? What are you doing with it?
My food taster.
Okay,
I
figure that out. You can discuss that with you.
She shouldn't go out to dinner with the Associated Industries.
No, there's some very fine people.
It was a joke.
Suzanne
right.
Bump, thank you for sharing this with us. Good luck in the next 24 hours.
Oh, I appreciate your willingness to entertain the idea.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much for being here, Auditor Bump.
You see Senator Bulger, tell him I say hi, too, but I haven't seen him in a long time.
Auditor Suzanne Bump. Okay, up next, are you somebody who has always applied the 5-second rule to drop food? Are you a waste not, want not kind of person? We have got some pretty shocking news to share with you on the old 5-second rule. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
More than half of recent graduates are unemployed or underemployed.
On Campus is WGBH's higher ed desk.
With the cost of college soaring, more and more students are demanding a return on investment.
When a student comes here, they've got a whole list of courses they're supposed to take. They know what they need to do to get a degree. They don't know what they need to do to get a job.
Listen for reports from Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Olin College of Engineering, working to educate the next generation of engineering innovators to solve the world's complex technical challenges. More information online at olin.edu. And JLL, Jones Lang LaSalle, has shortened its name, but not its commitment to providing global real estate advice, market insight, and service. More information at jll.com/Boston.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And there's some good news out there for sloppy eaters, I guess you'd call them. Researchers have apparently scientifically proven, this is in the UK, that the five-second rule is legit. That means if you drop something that you're eating, it is apparently safe to eat it if it's been on the ground for fewer than 5 seconds. Of course, what kind of food you drop and on what kind of flooring changes the bacterial load of your food. We'll get into that in a couple of minutes. So we want to know, are you someone who has always applied the five-second rule to drop food? Are you a waste-not-want-not kind of person? Or does the idea of even entertaining the notion of eating something that was floor-borne make you sick? At 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970 is our number.
Here's the big breaking news, though, that certain dry foods, like a cookie,
Maybe
able to do well on the floor for up to 30 seconds.
Well, you know,
That is a big deal. So if you drop things on the floor, I think we've all become a nation of germaphobes anyway. I don't think you should worry about that, this kind of stuff that much. But if you drop a cookie on the floor, especially if you drop it on carpet, you can go for a full 30 seconds.
You can go days. If there's carpet and you drop a cookie on the floor, just pick it up after the dog has licked it and do whatever
you think
you want.
About, you know, you think about what do you actually – okay, I guess you could worry about, you know, all the chemicals and the floor cleaner stuff that you don't want to get in your
– there are bacteria – even these people, Marjorie, at Aston University in Birmingham, England –
I think we are a little obsessive about bacteria, Jim. You know,
let me be clear here. If we're going to cite the researchers. The researchers – I've never heard of the place. Aston University, it's in Birmingham in the UK, say there will be some bacteria, especially on wet food, not cookies, within the 5 seconds. But the bacterial load is so small after 3 or 4 seconds – that you're perfectly fine.
Yeah, but we've turned into like a bacteria phobic nation. I mean, everybody runs around. Although I think it's diminishing a little bit. The Purell obsession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was Purell everywhere
of course.
I think that's on moving back a little bit because people realize that you need some good germs. I don't think you have to worry. I mean, I think people that worry about this stuff are a little bit crazy. It's a little bit too much. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Are you happy to know that if you drop your food, you really do have 5 seconds before you're, as they put it in this story, playing Russian roulette with your gut? Are you thrilled to know that for certain floor surfaces like carpets and certain hard foods like cookies or certain candies, you can drop things for a full 30 seconds and pick them up and eat them? How upsetting it is if you're eating something like, you know, and this is gooey, so not the chopped liver, maybe chopped liver for you.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like chocolate, like a big, thick chocolate cake.
And you've
eaten, you have one piece left and you're savoring it and you drop it on the floor.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to lose that last piece.
Do you know who would eat it, by the way?
So you have 30 seconds.
Do you know who would eat it?
I would eat it.
Suzanne Bump, the auditor, before she left, what did she say to us? Even if it's wet food, she just picks it up if it's within the 5 seconds and washes it off. Now, before we start, we have to acknowledge the only research prior to this research at Aston University in the UK was out of Clemson University in the U.S.
Correct.
And this has been totally debunked, but we want to be fair. Clemson University food scientist Paul Dawson, his view, well, let's hear what he had to say. This is 2007. Here's what he said about the five-second rule.
Five-second rule is a popular belief that if you drop food on the floor and pick it up within 5 seconds, it won't be too germ-laden to eat. It's not true, and we've proven it. It's, well, baloney.
Well, he says it's baloney. But the bottom line is, which is a good line for Paul Dawson out of Clemson, the latest research is out of the UK, and apparently if you were within 5 seconds, even with the wettest of foods, Marjorie, the answer is it is A-OK. Now, let's be practical so we don't have to waste time with these kinds of notions. I think Suzanne Bump is right. If the bologna that you dropped, even if you pick it up in 2 seconds, if you dropped it on cat hair, you should probably
rinse it.
No, you rinse it off.
No, I think if it's covered in hair, then all bets are off.
That's the no-second rule?
And maybe if you drop it like in the middle of Grand Central Station or something,
yeah,
or Penn Station.
No, I hadn't thought of
Grand Central Station is actually kind of nice. Penn Station, let's say.
I don't think the floor is that nice,
actually. Or the bus terminal. You know what I'm saying? Then you kind of, everybody's got mud and all the kind of stuff, or hair. That's a different story.
Let's stay in our own kitchens.
In your kitchen.
Yeah.
What are you worried about? Is there nuclear waste on your kitchen floor
or
something like that? I don't think so, for the most part. And a lot of us now are into those holistic cleaners. You get them at Whole Foods and stuff like that. They're all full of chemicals. And I don't know. I think a little Murphy's oil soap, which is not at Whole Foods. Well, you can get it at Whole Foods, but it's in the regular supermarket. I think it's got a nice kind of smell to it anyway. It might kind of spice up your food.
I've found, actually, if you drop chopped liver, since I mentioned that, and wash it with little Murphy's soap, it's good to go.
Je ne sais quoi.
877-301-8970 apparently is great news for sloppy eaters like me and others that the 5-second rule is completely for real and legit. We want to know what your practices have been and if you're celebrating this research news out of Birmingham in the UK.
Let's start with Barbara in Rhode Island. Hi, Barbara.
Hey, Barbara.
How are you?
Excellent, great. Thank you.
Love this. There is no way, no splitting of hairs and seconds.
Yeah.
Or retrieve a peanut butter jelly sandwich, jelly side down, in a house that has 4 kids, 2 dogs, and some cats.
Well, Barbara, don't go away. Marjorie Egan probably consumes more peanut butter in 1 year, out of a jar, by the way.
I do. I love it.
Than any human I've ever known. What is your position on the peanut butter falling on the floor?
Well, Barbara says, you know, the jelly face down with a house full of dogs and cats. I mean, that brings up the hair issue,
well, you
which
have a dog.
Jim has just mentioned. I do. He doesn't shed, though. It's actually the first dog I've ever had that doesn't
shed.
Great. It's a wonderful thing. But, Barbara, that's the problem. You can't pick it up with hair all over it, correct?
You can make a nice vinaigrette with Murphy's oil.
Nice vinaigrette. She's laughing at her own joke. Barbara, nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
You know what I love about this story before we get to Sheila?
What?
Not only do I love the outcome of this research, I love that there is actually a university that is expending resources on proving that the 5-second rule has merits. Is that great?
I know.
Is merit.
Where do people get these kind of jobs?
I love it.
I mean,
I agree with you.
But I also love it because I'm anti all this Purell stuff. I think we've become ridiculous about
Purell
it.
Purell Nation, I agree.
I know. Remember one of our previous producers used to carry the Purell
in
his pocket all the time.
The other John, not John Parker, another John.
He was a young guy. He was obsessed about germs.
We thought he was kidding when he said it to us. It was during a show. We were discussing how we were all Purelled up in this country. He typed on our little screen that he carries in his pocket. I type back, we don't believe it for a second. And what emerges from his jeans pocket?
Did.
A little tiny container of Purell.
He takes it with him everywhere. Sheila from Kingston. What do you think, Sheila?
Hi, Sheila.
Hi.
Hi.
I agree with you guys. Within reason, I would think that the 5-second rule is fine. I've always done the 5 seconds. I mean, if it drops on your own kitchen floor, there's no hair on it. 5-second rule is fine.
But Sheila, let's be clear. You do distinguish between wet and dry food being dropped. Is that correct?
True. However, there's still wet or dry. Sometimes you can just rinse it off. I mean, drops on the floor for a second. Yeah.
Now, Sheila, here's the test. What's your favorite cookie, Sheila?
My favorite cookie would be peanut butter cookie.
Perfect. Let's assume you dropped the peanut butter cookie on the floor and you forgot that you dropped it. And it's the next day. And at the same time, and you see it down there, it's the last one. You go for it, right?
That one I go for and give it to the dog. Right?
Oh, that's...
Yeah.
That is totally unnecessary
care. You can't go for it the next day because
it's stale. Sheila, thank you for the call.
It's stale. So what is your position here? You've been close to the vest, Jim. Where are you? If you drop it, you brought in some Chinese food today.
It was
very delicious, actually. Thank you very much. If you drop some of those wonderful little brown rice bits on the floor.
It's called brown rice.
It's
if I
brown
dropped
rice.
It on the floor,
that's right. What would you do?
I would have eaten it off the floor. I mean, I only had so much with me today. Even without this research, prior to having read it, my view was, hey, it's all I've got. My whole life, even though we've never been germophobes like we are today, even though you think there's some
total
retreat.
Germophobes.
Even decades ago, 20 years ago, before this germaphobe movement started, for lack of a better expression, my attitude was, if you're really into something, I mean, obviously you're right. If you drop it on something that's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we just got, then don't eat. But too much. Rinse it off. Like Suzanne, she's the auditor. Would she not know what the answer is?
She's the state auditor. She's meticulous.
If she eats it, then so would I.
Exactly. Billy from Dorchester, what do you think about the 5-second rule or the good news about the 30-second rule for hard food?
I don't care so much about the time that it's spent on the floor. I care more how much do I like or value that food item.
I wish I had said that. Of course that's it. Go ahead, Billy. That's perfect.
If I would have fed that thing to the dog while the host had its back turned in the first place, then I'll cite the rule. And I'll say, germ load. Terrible thing. I can't eat that. I'm sorry. But if I want to eat that, 2 minutes, depending on the food, could be 5 minutes. Peanut butter is a great thing. I eat a spoonful of peanut butter at my office every single day. I'm in my office manager's office having a conversation. It went on a little too long, like me now. Suddenly the weight on the spoon releases. And I hear a, and I look down, I look up at my office manager, and there is a lump of peanut butter on her carpet. So I gingerly bend down, and I pick it back up with a spoon. I say, sorry, I wipe it with a napkin. It's not really clean. I go back later and do that. But and she said, what are you going to do with that? I said, I'm going to eat it. And it's peanut butter. It's my daily peanut butter, which I love, and I ate it. There was no hair attached to it. If it had hair, it would have hit the trash. That's it.
Good
okay,
you,
now, Billy.
Billy,
before you go, I just have to know, because I am very much into peanut butter.
What you is, eat it out
what
of the jar
your,
with a spoon, too.
I do. What is your preferred brand?
Well, my office actually supplies peanut butter. Times are tough, so the tuna fish is not in the cabinet anymore, but there's usually Skippy, Chunky in the cabinet somewhere
okay.
in the kitchen.
Mm.
And it's not the greatest. It's fine. I prefer things all natural at home.
Yeah, me too. I have switched.
You can make your own at Whole Foods, you know.
Well, you can make your own, but they don't put any salt in it. Then you have to salt
it
yourself.
That's true. That's true.
I used to be a Skippy person, but now I've gone total the natural peanut butter, and it's just the best. I absolutely love it. The creamy, actually, $3.65 at Whole Foods. It's
That's
quite
great,
good.
Marjorie.
Well, thank you.
Billy, thank you for your
that with
call.
You, Jim.
You know, Billy, I think, captured the essence of what I
he
wish
did.
I had said this earlier. You tell me, I don't care how germophobic somebody listening to the show at 877-301-8970 is, if you have been thinking about a particular food in your refrigerator and you have the last bite of that thing and you drop it on the floor, you tell me that anybody is not going to eat that thing? I mean, it's just not possible.
No, especially if it's in your own house.
And
but
it's the last bite of something you've been thinking about for hours. You're going
to
eat it.
But listen to this. They talk in this story that consuming food dropped on the floor still carries an infection risk. It very
small.
Much, yeah, and it talks about playing Russian roulette with your gut. This is why people are so hysterical. You feel as though if your children, you have to tell your children all the time, don't pick that up, don't pick that up, don't pick that up. And you know, you notice this. Anybody who's a Catholic out here will know this. You know, they have the handshake of peace at the end of Mass.
Yep.
And you have a quarter of the people now, they're afraid to shake your hand. They're like waving to you, or they pretend they have a cold.
You've said that
like
to me.
That.
Is that really true?
Yes.
They will not shake your hand?
Yeah. And not only that, they have Purell on the altar now so that anybody's going to hand out the communion.
That's not true.
Absolutely. But you can see everybody Purelling up at the altar, lest you think that they'll be handing you out, you know, to the cup that you share, which
I understand
supposedly
what it is.
Is so loaded with alcohol that it cuts down
kills
the germs,
all the bacteria,
supposedly.
Right.
I don't know if that's really true, but that's the legend anyway. But they're pureeing up before they come out to give you the host of the or the cup with the wine in it. So it's just kind of crazy. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't he not shake anybody's hand because
Trump,
he's such a
well,
nervous
apparently when
wreck
he was
about
quasi
it?
Running for president, I had thought that he started shaking hands, but his traditional position
yeah.
is not to shake
Here's
hands.
Here's the thing. I used to work in a daycare. Anybody that works in a daycare or school, you know this whole thing. You go to work in a daycare. The first month you're there, you're sick nonstop mm-hmm. because of all the germs of the little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then you build up your immunities, and you're like superwoman for the rest of the year. You never get a cold. Everybody else is sniffling. You're fine because you've been sort of inoculated. Same thing I think is true in school. But we've become this nation that's like afraid of getting any germs, and we're hysterical about our kids getting any germs. And so that's why we're hysterical about a food for 5 seconds on the floor. I mean, come on.
By the way, I'm totally with you, Marjorie. And I would argue if there are people listening to the show who are people of principle to show that they agree with
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely.
I would tonight throw your favorite food on the floor. No, really. Don't wait for it to drop. It could be weeks. Just take something you really like, toss it on the kitchen
yeah.
floor, count to 4.5. And then pop it in.
Well, there are certain things. I mean, you can't, you know, if you spill the yogurt in the floor, Jim, it's going to
all over. I wouldn't
be
doing that.
No, you can't do that. But like a nice piece of meat, filet, chicken, cookies, chocolate cake in my case.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something that is, as the previous caller said, that you are really attached to in a big time way. You scoop that baby up and just pop it right in.
Beautiful.
Let's go to Pete in Ashland. Hi, Pete.
Hello, Pete.
Hey, so I was just going to call and say the study comes out with basically what I've been saying for years. But I just want to remind people that it does not stand in a house with cats.
No.
Because
the hair.
Greater than 50% majority of cats have a very specific parasite that causes brain damage.
What?
Oh, God.
Toxoplasmosis gondii.
Wait, for humans? Wait. It causes that for humans or for other cats?
It causes brain damage in humans. And in cats, it's pretty benign. But in humans and rats, it causes brain damage in very specific areas that causes us to be more reckless and promiscuous and take more chances and generally lower IQ.
Pete, I don't want to question your scientific background, but in light of the fact that there are zillions of people in America with cats, why are we all not suffering brain damage?
It's actually been shown that around 30% of people in America do actually have this parasite, unfortunately.
They do? Could you do us a favor? When you hang up, send us an email with this thing, because we want to do a little research for all of our cat owners in our audience. We got it. Pete, thank you kindly for the call.
I knew there was a reason I didn't want to get a cat.
Really?
Yeah.
He's calling back with the dog research that he's doing in a... Now, if you just tuned in, and
well, dogs will eat anything, as people know.
We know that.
Don't want to go into detail, but there's no 5-second rule. Let's just say.
No, of course. If you're wondering why there's exultation in the studio, it's because this morning Marjorie and I were lucky enough to read a study. Well, we didn't read a study. We read a report on a study of Aston University. Are you familiar with that university?
No, I'm not.
Aston University in Birmingham in the United Kingdom. And I'll read you the first sentence of the excellent story. It says, a UK study is contradicting the conventional wisdom that the 5-second rule is mostly bunk, claiming the amount of time food is on the ground really does have an effect on how much bacteria gets on the dropped food, meaning their point is that 5 seconds is perfectly fine in almost all cases. Beyond that, other than a cookie, a dry item, as Marjorie has said about 15 times so far, because obviously she is cookie-friendly, a dry item is generally fine for 30 seconds and up.
Let's go
By the way, why wouldn't it be fine for longer than 30 seconds? If something is dry, why can't it sit there for a couple of minutes? I don't get it at all.
Well, I think that, like I said, these stories are making you think as though you're taking your life in your hands by picking up something off the floor that's been there for just a few seconds. So I think that they view themselves as being very bold by saying you can wait as long as 30 seconds for a cookie. I mean, it's just kind of, the whole thing is just kind of crazy.
You know what we need, Marjorie, to move this conversation? We need a microbiologist. Oh, there is a microbiologist on the phone. David from Lexington. You're next on Boston Public Radio. How are you?
Hi. Good. How are you, Jim and Marjorie?
So what do you know?
Well, I should correct one thing. I'm a journalist who writes about microbiology.
Close enough.
Okay. Well, you know, we're veritable ecosystems of microbes. Our guts have about 3 pounds of microbes in them on average. Assuming that we haven't had too many antibiotics in our lives, and we were born by a normal vaginal birth, we have a healthy, diverse microbiota. And if that's the case, you know, we're not going to be harmed by getting a few bacteria in our mouths.
Good.
So is that, wait, David, stop right there for a second. Does that make you feel better? Does that give you a level of confidence you need?
Okay, you are an expert in this, David. You are a microbiologist.
No, so he's a reporter, a journalist who covers microbiology.
Okay, a journalist who reports microbiology. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah.
So are we needlessly fanatical about this, David?
Yes, ridiculously so. You know, and in some parts of our behavior, we ignore it. I suspect that... eating in a lot of restaurants is probably more dangerous than picking something up on our off of our floors, but, you know.
Marjorie and I have both worked in restaurants in our youth, so we can attest to the facts there. David, thank you for
Let me tell you a story.
Go ahead.
When I was a kid, we had just come to Cambridge from the West Coast when I was 4. We went out to Cranes Beach, and I quickly discovered that the soda bottles on the beach that people had littered, still had a little bit of soda in them. And so I went running around the beach drinking out of empty soda bottles.
That is disgusting,
and
David.
Some of them, actually, the soda tasted kind of sour. And years later, I realized that had been beer. But, you know, I didn't get sick from that.
Pretty good story, David. Thank you for the call.
Thank you. And there's a man with some expertise.
Yeah, I mean, I my hope is that based on what David has told you and based upon the research out of the UK, that your fears have been allayed. See, my view is, despite the germophobic movement, since it's a tough economy, and obviously people are short on dough, and secondly, you're not as into food as I am. But tell me there's not...
It'd be hard to be as into food as you are.
Fine. Tell me there's not a 4 o'clock in your afternoon when you're writing a column where you don't say to yourself, I cannot wait till I'm done this column so I can have X. Is it, you think like that, do you not?
Well, I actually don't wait till I'm done the column.
Okay,
get the X immediately.
And if you, as I said...
Usually it's chocolate.
As I said 10 minutes ago, if you drop that last piece of chocolate on the floor, research out of the UK or no research out of the UK, you're eating the chocolate. Have you ever thrown the chocolate out? Tell the truth. Okay, fine.
Unless I dropped it in some really disgusting... thing.
Exactly.
And then you have to throw it out.
Well, yeah, the solution to that is don't drop it in a disgusting thing. And then, okay, one or two more quick ones because I think we're breaking some real ground here. Helen, you're in the car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. I don't know if you can beat David from Lexington, but go ahead, Helen.
I don't know if I can beat David from Lexington either, but I am both a mother and a veterinarian, and I think it's sometimes very difficult to walk that fine line between the five-second rule in immune system stimulation and, oh my goodness, that's just so contaminated, don't do it.
Okay, so what is the fine line for you, mom and veterinarian? When do you say to the kids, it's okay, you can eat it, and when do you say to them, forget it?
It depends on how hungry and fussy they are and where
exactly.
they go.
Yeah. You're an honest woman, Helen.
If we're at home and there's no visible contamination, I'm good with stimulating their immune systems. But if we're at the clinic that I work at and it falls on the floor, there is no such thing as a five-second rule at the vet clinic. That's just disgusting.
And because of the dogs and the cats and everything else being there.
Exactly.
Hey, Helen, while you're here, I don't know if you were listening about 3 minutes, 5 minutes ago, when somebody called to talk about a disease that 30% of us allegedly have that we've contracted from our cats, that some brain thing.
Yes, was that
is
right?
Is there any truth to that or what?
That is called toxoplasmosis, and it does exist. It actually can make cats extremely ill and can be transmitted to humans. However, the damage that it can do to human beings is controversial, and the studies that have been done conflict. So no one really knows. But the good news is that if you wash your hands before you eat, you should be okay. And you know, don't drop your food on the floor with the cat defecated.
Helen, well,
now,
thank
I have,
you for
I
that,
have
Helen.
One more question, Helen. How about, should, okay. Should you let your dogs kiss you?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this.
No.
Oh, okay. Helen.
So how about licking your hands?
They can lick my hands, but I wash my hands.
Yeah, okay.
So you just have to think about where those dogs go.
Yeah, it's really pretty gross. Know?
Helen, you only live once. Get with the program. Helen, thank you so much for veterinary expertise. This is our last one on this. Linda and Beverly, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Wrap it up for us, Linda.
I used to raise German Shepherds. Let me tell you, it was a fight for whatever drove dropped on the floor. And yes, you do. The puppies, you let the puppies kiss you when they're up to 3 weeks old, because then they'll always remember you.
Oh.
And as kids growing up, didn't we all eat a pound of dirt a year out in, you know, outside? Food drops on the ground. You
great
pick it
point.
Up quickly.
Yeah, you always, the lifesavers and stuff like that. You always picked up your candy off the ground. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Linda, thank you for your contribution. This is an uplifting discussion. I mean, literally and figuratively.
The bottom line here is, Jim, you can just dive right down and pick up anything else you may
Well, I got news for you. I hadn't fully intended to do that. Even had the professors from that university not done their work.
Up next, we are going to be joined by the former ambassador to the Vatican and Boston Mayor Ray Flynn. He's going to tell us about Pope Francis, his review after a year, what he thought of the controversy over the St. Patrick's Day parade. Did he go to the breakfast? That conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The deadline for the Affordable Care Act is the end of the month, but getting people to sign up is just step one. Step number two, getting the system to catch up.
You know, there haven't been enough staff or enough funds to pay for overtime to be able to process this backlog as quickly as we'd like.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Our series Diagnosis Camden continues next time on Marketplace from APN.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
It was a huge mess, you know, that old Big Bang. Is that mess still detectable? Is the gravitational energy that keeps us stuck to the Earth an echo from 4 billion years ago, give or take a trillionth of a second? Gravity's waves from the Big Bang's ripples. We'll explain everything next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And Floor, providing custom area rugs, runners, and wall-to-wall carpeting with Floor carpet design squares. In-store design assistance available at their store at the corner of Newbury and Clarendon. That's FLOR.com. Carpet is boring. This isn't carpet. And Father Brown, a Catholic priest with an uncanny knack for solving crime, puts his unique talents to work in the quiet English countryside. Don't miss Father Brown, tonight at 8 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Ray Flynn. He was the mayor of Boston, the ambassador to the Vatican. Mayor Flynn, it's good to see you.
Jim, it's great to be on the program. Marjorie, how are you doing?
I'm doing very, very well. So,
good.
Jim Browdy was the maestro of the St. Francis.
Don't say that.
Linda Dorsina Fori may have been up on the stage, but Jim was, you know, running things for NACN in the background there. So what did you think of the breakfast this year? Were you there?
No, I wasn't there. Babysitting calls. I have 17 grandchildren.
Oh,
somebody's
got
to take care of them. we had a lot of fun, though. I watched it on TV.
Yeah.
I thought it was excellent. Excellent breakfast on New England Cable News. And then I watched the parade on Broadway with all the kids. So we had a fun day and got a chance to talk to a lot of families. Everybody enjoyed the breakfast. Everybody loved the parade. So all's well that ends well.
Well, there's been a few big breakthroughs in this parade. I mean, there was a big controversy because Mass Equality wanted to march with a banner that identified them as a gay group, and that didn't pass muster with the Allied War veterans. But now we've learned that two different floats, well, not a float, I guess. One was a float and one was just people marching, one group marched with proclaiming diversity and inclusion, and a second group marched with this kind of float, and they're shooting out, you know, rainbow-colored, whatever's in the air and all that kind of stuff. So gay without saying they were gay and no big deal. So what do you think about this going forward?
You know, I recall, I forget exactly the year. It was after Jack Kennedy's assassination and Teddy Kennedy was the senator. And Teddy Kennedy marched in the St. Patrick's Day parade in South Boston. In back of him was Mel King. He had an NAACP float. And I talk to Mel King about this all the time. And here it was, supposedly, if you put focus of attention on it, probably would have been controversial. But it wasn't controversial. There wasn't a lot of attention to it. So it went uneventful. So, you know, I think the floats that you're referring to, I saw the whole parade. I don't even remember those floats to be the floats of diversity, to be honest with you. But, you know, getting back to the breakfast quickly, I thought Linda Fori did a special job. I wrote an article for the Boston Herald, and I said this is her real opportunity to demonstrate. And I think I told you that, Jim, right here. I said, you know, Eddie Fori, that's her father-in-law, who I've known since my early days of politics because he worked in Bulge's office. And he is very good at this. And he orchestrated the whole thing, and I knew it would work out very well. And I particularly loved showing the picture of Billy Linehan, you know, dressed up as George Washington.
That was great.
And then tying in the evacuation of Boston. And Billy, of course, evacuated Boston. He's in Ireland. And then she says, oh, by the way, in case you don't know it, Billy Linehan is on the left. On the right, of course, is George Washington's horse.
Backwards.
The rear end of his
head. But, you know, stay on Linda. If I had, we had a conversation 10 years ago, Ray Flynn, and I had said there's going to be a Haitian-American woman from Dorchester emceeing the St. Patrick's Day breakfast in 2014, what would you have said to me? Not whether it should have happened, but can you envision that 10 years ago?
Well, when you see the district lines drawn differently, 10 years ago, no, I would not have seen that. But the way the district lines for the Senate were drawn, it was inevitable that the power of the Senate would be in the Dorchester district. So,
you know, I don't want to read too much into it, but isn't it good for the city that happened? Even if people think that the breakfast is, you know, get rid of it, put it out of its misery. It's not funny. Wasn't that an important moment for the city?
I think what is good for the city of Boston, the person who gets the most amount of votes, who serves that district, is the person who's the host of that parade. That's what I think is good for the city.
Let's go back to the parade for 1 second. You know Wacko Hurley for a long time.
Right.
You know what? Everybody knows how this broke down. He said, as Marjorie said, yes to mass equality, but not yes to mass equality if it turns out they identify themselves as gay. That's seen as a political statement, etc. So Marty Walsh, who fought pretty hard here, goes up to Wacko Hurley either today or in 11 months and says, hey, there were, as Marjorie Egan described, was a float, and there was another group of gay, either veterans or just gay and lesbian Americans, who made it clear they were that. You said you wouldn't allow that to happen. It happened. There was no downside. No young children were terrified. Everything went perfectly fine. What does he say to Marty Walsh's, I won't call it a demand, request next year to go one step further and to end this controversy, even though we know he's got a Supreme Court decision that says he can do whatever he wants?
Well, I think that if it's handled in a more diplomatic way in terms of, you know, no winners, no losers, everybody comes out of this thing looking good. Look, Wacko has a constituency that he has to represent. Marty Walsh has a constituency in a city that he has to represent. Everybody has a role to play. This is like Shakespeare. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. So everybody's got a job to do. And frankly, nobody got hurt. The lesbian gay community certainly got their message out. It went national. They got good publicity out of it. Wacko stood his ground on behalf of the Allied War veterans. The people of South Boston, they're not unhappy. I'm not unhappy. The political people come out of this thing looking good. I think everybody did all right, and all's well that ends well.
But, you know, listen, you've grown up your whole life, and you've lived in South Boston. You're coming at this from a perspective of someone who has grown up in South Boston. I'm coming at this from a perspective of someone who's Irish-American and has lived in Boston or right outside of Boston for a very long time. I guess, to me, I'm embarrassed that my Irish Catholic heritage is associated with this very tiny group of people that are so recalcitrant. And that's what I don't understand.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm embarrassed about. The people portraying South Boston as some sort of caricature, as some sort of parade. South Boston, the Irish, is not a parade. That's not what St. Patrick's Day is about. St. Patrick's Day is about heritage. It's about tradition. It's about respect for our veterans, respect for our values. It's all of those things. And look, you know, you have to live by those traditions in the faith of what that parade represents. And I think that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, when you mentioned a minute ago,
I guess
Ray
it
Flynn,
represents to me something
well,
different.
Well, you're looking at it a different point of view. I'm not looking at it from a standpoint of what's good for the media or what's good for anything. I'm looking what is keeping with tradition, keeping with the St. Patrick theme. What does the Allied veterans represent? Look, they represent, whether you like them or not, they represent the veterans movement. My son was the Grand Marshal last year. He's been in the Navy 25 years, Iraq, Afghanistan. Now, that's what I want to see protected. I want to see that point of view respected. I've seen it for 70 years, and I don't want to see it get distorted.
Yeah, but without belaboring this forever, we had the guy who's head of Veterans for Peace here the other day who said, and who served in Vietnam, Pat Scanlon. They're not allowed to march in the parade.
Well, they did. They marched with Stevie Lynch.
Well, an individual or two did, but Veterans for Peace themselves were, as an organization, no political statement except peace, were forced to march a mile. But forget that for a second. Let me get back to your comment just a minute ago, Ray Flynn. You said if it was handled more diplomatically, this might have worked out in a different way. Is the suggestion in that Marty Walsh was the one who was undiplomatic, too high profile?
No, I'll tell you what. Let me give you an analogy that you remember very well and Marjorie will remember. We had the busing in Boston. It was a circus. It disrupted the whole city. The public school system has never recovered. It didn't have the level of political organization or diplomacy.
It was handled badly.
Exactly, Marjorie. Okay, let me pat myself on the back here a bit. during the integration of public housing, everybody told me that this was going to be a disaster. This would be worse than busing, because it wasn't just busing kids into the town. It was people of color that were going to be living in South Boston. I was making a big mistake by integrating public housing. I did not do one single interview, and neither did the NAACP, and neither did the church. We just made it happen. Finally, it happened. People were predicting the worst. The cameras left. The press left. Everybody went home. Those people, to this day, have not had any problem growing up in South Boston. That's what my idea of diplomacy is creating a win-win-win situation. I don't want to be a hero on the integration of public housing. I just want to see it done. And I think you can do that in future parades in South Boston.
You know, Ray Flynn, it's no secret. In fact, I think last time you were here, we discussed your relationship with Tom Menino, and you were candid to say that one of the reasons it was strained, I'll put words in your mouth, but I think it's accurate, was that he never reached out to you, never asked you to help in some fashion. But obviously, we learned on Sunday when we picked up the Boston Globe that he's going through quite a battle. What was your reaction to that, Ray Flynn?
You know, you know, I've known Tom Menino from a political point of view probably longer than anybody in the city. I mean, he supported me when I ran for mayor. I supported him to become president of the city council. And I left for
mayor. Which, for those who were recently to town, he would not have been elevated to mayor when you moved on to the Vatican.
So there's a chemistry there. There's friendship there that goes back over all these years. How do I feel? I feel sad that he's not feeling well. And I hope with all the sincerity in my body that he gets through this. And I hope that he lives a long, happy, productive life. And I think he is entitled to that, and I certainly am rooting for him.
Have you spoken to him? Or
I sent a message to him, but I sent the message, as I do. And he doesn't have to call me. He doesn't have to come over to my house, so I don't have to have a meeting with him. But I just want him to know how I feel, and I'm rooting for him.
Now, Ray Flynn, one of the reasons we've had you on the show several times, beyond the fact that we respect you, is we assume at some point as a favor, to return the favor, you will get us Pope Francis on the show. So until you get us Pope Francis, you're going to do that, are you? Can you pull that off?
Well, I'm going next month to Rome.
You are? Ooh, yeah. Will you see him? By the way, for those who don't know, you knew him quite well.
Right.
When he was a cardinal. Do you expect to see him?
I hope so. I'm going for the canonization of John Paul II. I've been invited by official sources for the canonization of John Paul II and John the 23rd. So it's going to be an extraordinary opportunity for me. I'll be delivering a kind of a history of John Paul II to a group of world journalists. So
year one just finished about a week ago, year one of Pope Francis. What's the Ray Flynn review of the first 12 months of the new pontiff?
Well, I guess I'm particularly impressed with his humility, his genuineness. He's reached out to good people who have fallen away from the Catholic Church, good people. And they wanted a reason to come back home. The church has had some troubling times, and there's enough reason there to be disillusioned with some of the decisions of the church and some of its leaders. I think Pope Francis he's starting to heal those wounds. And quite frankly, people want to come back home, and I think they are coming back home.
You know, I think people know who listen to the show, I'm the non-Catholic in the room of the three of us. And I have to say, as a non-Catholic, my position on him was nothing but extraordinary praise for reaching out to poor people, disenfranchised people. The thing that really troubled me, though, that we wanted your reaction on, is after the UN commission, and I can't remember its name, that looked into the whole sexual abuse crisis and was not very complimentary towards the Vatican several weeks ago, the Pope did an interview with an Italian daily, and here were his words, which I have to say I was shocked by. The Catholic Church, this is the Pope speaking, is perhaps the lone public institution to have moved with transparency and responsibility. No one has done more, yet the Church is the only one to have been attacked. And one, I'd like your response to what your reaction was to those words, particularly in light of the fact that so many survivors, and I'm sure you know quite a few, are from within the, you know, within the sound of our voices, who have been hoping that this Pope was finally going to get to the issue that was most important to them. What do you think of what Pope Francis said there, Ray Flynn?
Well, I think the Church has, in fact, tried to reach out to many of the survivors. I was in Washington, D.C., when the Pope met with all, a couple of years ago, I guess, when the Pope met with all the, many of the survivors.
Benedict.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he met with many of the survivors. I helped in the, that process. We did it in a nice, low-key way. And it was successful, the survivors, many of whom said to me personally that they were, they appreciated what the way it was handled. Look, Pope Francis is not a political expert. And the Vatican is not the most astute political. It's not the Kennedy School of Government. And, you know, they don't make the right political decisions, but I believe that they're always trying to be consistent with their moral interpretation of the teachings of the Church. There's the conflict. They, many of the teachings of the Catholic Church do not necessarily conform to political correctness in this day and age, but that's the way it is, and there's not much you can do about it.
You know, I just wonder, when you go over for the canonization of John Paul II, what do? They have, like, these big events? Do they have, like, garden parties? Do you have, like, cocktails and hors d'oeuvres in some sort of, you know, Vatican patio or something like that? Is it fun?
Well, there's going to be a convocation. There's going to be a synod, and I'm part of it. And there's going to be all kinds of different people from across the world. Lech Walesa is going to be one of the,
really?
One of the conveners. Ray Flynn. Newt Gingrich, believe it or not.
Big convert.
Yeah, he's a convert
to
Catholicism.
Yeah. And, I think Callista is his wife.
Yeah,
Callista
right.
said, get
yeah,
with she, the program, Newt.
Yeah, she wrote the movie that
That's
I
right.
talked to. It's a nine,
That's
nine,
right.
9 days that changed the world. And I'm happy to say that we're going to be talking about John Paul II. They asked me, because I knew him so well, and talk about the Cold War. I'm going to talk about, I talked to John Paul II numerous times, Ronald Reagan numerous times, Lech Walesa, General Jaruzelski from Poland, and also Mikhail Gorbachev. I probably have a unique perspective of the importance of the collapse of the Cold War and the collapse of communism in Poland, the Eastern Europe, and across the world. So that's one of the big issues that we're going to be talking about. And I'm going to try to talk about, to be honest with you, the challenge then when the Church and political leaders worked together. They had an enormous impact and society, in changing society, the Cold War, the greatest threat to modern history. And now, what is the threat? There's still a big threat that Francis and Obama and all these other people are facing. Well, look at the situation here in Ukraine. This is almost the start of another Cold War in America, as far as I'm concerned. And I follow it very, very closely. I am not happy, and nobody should be happy, what's happening in the world today, not just from a standpoint of instability, but from a standpoint of human rights. I think you're going to see a crisis in the collapse of human rights in the world today.
You know, Ray Flynn, I hate to go from the serious to the silly, but you did sidestep the question about the hors d'oeuvres. Do they have, like, do you get to, like, hobnob with the cardinals and have, like, you know, are there any, like, receptions, I guess I'm wondering? And if so, what do they serve?
I hope so. God almighty. Gee, what do you think I'm going there for?
Little pastas or, you know, is there any high?
Bring it all on. Yeah, yeah. Bring it all on. Kathy and I will be there. We'll be the first in line.
Okay.
Hey, Ray Flynn, before you go away, we rarely have two jocks on the show right in a row, but we have Shira Springer, who not only is a great reporter for the Boston Globe sports pages, but also a great athlete. And we have with us in the studio a guy, I had forgotten this. You were not just a great basketball player. You were the, if I'm not wrong, the MVP of what essentially was March Madness in your time in 1963,
right.
The NIT tournament. You were the MVP of this. Yeah,
that's
look
right.
at the smile on his face.
Thank you. I told you to bring
no,
up.
I mean, that is so. So there was no, that was March Madness then. We have March Madness now. Do you do brackets? I mean, how closely do you, I mean, obviously you care about Providence and all that sort of
Providence
deal.
Did great the other night.
Yes, they did.
Against Creighton.
So how do you follow this thing?
Well, put it this way. Way, Jim, you're probably looking at the foremost authority expert in the world, you know what, in basketball and sports. I did a program one night for Cablevision in New York City around the draft. I think I got a zero in predicting. So you don't want to hear
Fine.
My predictions.
Okay,
thank you very much, though.
So here's my question then, final thought for you. You have three. You have one choice. You believe in the Lord. The Lord comes to you and says, Ray Flynn, you are the mayor of the city of Boston. You are the ambassador to the Vatican. You are the final cut for the Celtics, which was wildly unfair. You should have made the Celtics. You can only have one. You can either be a star guard for the Boston Celtics in your lifetime. You can be ambassador to the Vatican. I think I know what the answer is going to be. Or you can be the mayor of Boston, but you can't be all three. Which would you have chosen?
No, you should have phrased the question differently.
Well,
I could be president of the United States. All right, I could be governor of Massachusetts. I would rather play for the Celtics. Sign me up. I wish I played for the Celtics.
I knew that was, and you came pretty close, didn't you?
I love Red Auerbach more, almost as a father. He was my dear friend. I loved him. He only made one mistake in his life,
and that
is cutting Ray Flynn.
Good to talk to you, Mr. Mayor.
You didn't seek your revenge when you were the mayor against Red Auerbach, did you?
I spoke at his funeral, for God's sakes, at his request.
Okay.
Good to see you, Ray Flynn. Thank you.
Ray Flynn is, of course, the former mayor of Boston and was the MVP of back in the day of what used to be March, which is now March Madness. Thank you very much, Mayor Flynn, for being with us. Up next, Boston Globe sports writer Shira Springer joins us to talk NCAA brackets as well as the new guidelines for the Boston Marathon. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Joining us now in Studio 3 to talk about a range of things, from the unbeatable Warren Buffett to the Paralympics, and something I learned about him just today, to new security rules for the upcoming Boston Marathon, is Shira Springer. Shira is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hey, Shira, how are you?
Good. How are you guys?
So did you know before, we just said this, do you know that Ray Flynn was the MVP of what came before March Madness, the NIT
no
in 1963. Is that incredible?
No, and I just spoke to him in the hallway, and he told me he's run 31 marathons, and I had no idea about that.
I didn't know that either.
Oh, he was famous for running around the city of Boston like 12 miles, 14 miles. I remember when he was the mayor. He would run everywhere, and I don't know if he still runs now. I mean, he's getting to be an older kind of guy. But
I don't know. I have faith, though. He could train and come back and get another Boston marathon under his belt.
Well, did you ever see him play basketball? I mean, when he was a younger guy, watching him play basketball, I mean, you could see why he was the MVP. He is really good. He was a really great athlete.
Okay, Shira Springer, virtually everybody except for Marjorie is filling in their NCAA brackets in the next couple of days. And 15 million of those people are hoping that they will win a mere $1 billion when they submit their brackets to Warren Buffett and they pick all 63 games, 63 out of 63. Are you one of those 15 million people?
I am not one of those 15 million people.
Why is that? You don't
because
want to win
I know
the money?
How much the odds are incredibly stacked against me. I mean,
yeah. There's a little thing in the Globe today. Great little chart. How long are the odds to win this Buffett challenge?
So to start out with, the number of different conceivable brackets is something like 2 raised to the 63rd power, or about 9.22 quintillion possibilities.
Quintillion.
Okay. So to put it in terms that'll make it somewhat easier to understand, the U.S. population is about 318 million people. Each person in the U.S. would have to enter 29 billion distinctly different brackets in order for one person to get one bracket with every game correct.
So, you know, this is, you know, Warren Buffett is the celebrated leader in this country,
yeah,
except for people,
disappointed.
Some on the right don't like him because of the Buffett rule, they think is an Obama thing. But this is almost Donald Trumpian. I mean, everybody's been talking about
stunt.
It is purely a publicity
and
stunt.
And it goes back to one of the reasons why I didn't enter this contest. You know, there was first the long odds, but also when you go on to the homepage of what everybody's calling the Buffett Brackets Challenge,
right?
It's basically a data mining ploy for Quicken Loans, which is also the sponsor of this challenge. So you're asked to fill out all this personal information about your home loan. How are you happy with your home loan
rate?
To enter your bracket. Do you own your own home? Do you plan to own your own home? And then you can check a number of boxes, like do you want a home loan agent to give you a call? And in addition to that, you have to have a Yahoo account to register. So not only is it publicity for Warren Buffett and, you know, potential loan leads for Quicken Loans, it's also a big boon to Yahoo.
But, you know, I'm surprised because Warren Buffett really doesn't need the publicity. I mean, everybody knows who Warren Buffett is. It just seems a little low rent for him.
Well, I think it started out with the best of intentions. Hey, wouldn't this be fun? I'll award $1 billion to someone who gets a perfect bracket.
Right.
And I think, you know, also further spelling out how long the odds are, I believe ESPN has been running a brackets contest for 13 years. And in those 13 years, no one has had a perfect bracket. So, you know, not only are the odds for an individual year long, it's just not going to happen. So I think it started out with the best of intentions. And then it got, as many good things sometimes do, got very commercialized. Quicken Loans got involved. Yahoo got involved. Because you have to have people who can run and organize it. And then you end up at this point where it's more data mining and, you know, loan leads than it is about the NCAA tournament. And it's interesting because there are 15 million slots. I would have thought that people would have been clamoring to fill those slots. I checked today. You can still register for the Buffett brackets, which leads me to believe some people are sort of like, oh, neat gimmick, but not for me. I'll stick with my regular
office.
Well, they
don't want to give pool. Any information.
Yeah, exactly.
People are information phobic, as they should be.
Exactly.
You know, you're an investigative reporter. Marjorie is a columnist. So while Marjorie has been running around our newsroom trumpeting this little piece of information, I figured I'd ask you as an investigative reporter if it's true. There are reports that the number of vasectomies during the March Madness go
yes.
up dramatically. What's the rationale for this?
I have heard this too.
Well, the rationale, it makes sense. If you're gonna be home on the couch for a few days, what better time to be home on the couch if you are a man, and men are the only ones getting vasectomies, than during March Madness, right?
Perfect time to rest
exactly.
up and recover.
Exactly.
Could you research that for us and your next Proctor
right
editor
on
and see if we're talking to Shira Springer from the
Vasectomy
the
Project.
Globe.
Yes.
You know, you were there in Sochi. We spoke to you from Sochi. You had some great stories. You did some fabulous reporting. I have to say, I have not spent nearly enough attention on the Paralympics, particularly when I've read about who some of the competitors are. What I have been saying, by the way, there's this Samsung commercial. I don't usually talk about ads on this show. There is a Samsung commercial. I think it's Samsung that has images of some of the Paralympics waking up in the Olympians waking up in the morning. Performing in their events. That is one of the most beautiful, powerful things I've ever seen. You can Google it. But tell us a little bit about who these men and women in great numbers are that I guess it ended yesterday, competed in the Paralympics in Sochi after the Olympics that you were there for.
Well, in increasing numbers, they are U.S. military veterans. I think the statistics that they have this year is that of the 80-member U.S. team, Paralympic team, a little more than 20% or about 18 athletes are military veterans. That's up from 5 veterans in Vancouver. And the reason that they have so many of these military veterans is most of them are victims of IED explosions who
yeah.
have lost one or both of their legs. And they're competing in events like sled hockey, which is a big one for veterans, as well as alpine skiing and all the other semi-wide-ranging number of events that they have at the Paralympics. There's, you know, wheelchair curling and, you know, there's, you know, downhill skiing. There's also cross-country skiing. You sit in a sit-ski. It's pretty incredible. I mean, I've been a fan of sled hockey, which is a pretty incredible event for, gosh, maybe 6 or 7 years. If you get a chance to see it in
what
person.
Is it?
So they're basically sitting in a sled. The hockey players are sitting in a sled. And they have 2 sticks in their hand. They're about half the size of regular hockey sticks. On one end is sort of a pick, and they use that pick to propel themselves on these sleds down the ice. And on the other end is your regular hockey stick blade, which they use to shoot. So they're constantly propelling themselves and then flipping the stick and shooting. It's amazing to watch them in action.
Well, you think of the people that are running the marathon every year in those high-tech wheelchairs. I don't even want to call them wheelchairs because they look almost nothing like a wheelchair. Is there a proper name for those little machines those guys are on and gals are on that run the marathon?
Wheelchairs.
Well, okay, they are wheelchairs.
That's the term of art.
But I wondered, I should know this, but I don't. Are the alpine skiers, are they mostly people who are skiing with prosthetic legs, or are they people who are sitting and skiing?
So most of them, from what I've seen, there are different categories of disability. So
okay.
You do have a mix. There are skiers who are in sit skis. There are skiers who are amputees with one leg. There are also visually impaired skiers, which is an incredible event where you are led by a guide at something like 60 or 70 miles per hour down an alpine ski course.
A person guide?
A person guide.
Making a noise?
They have intercom. They have like headsets, that one for the blind skier or the visually impaired skier and one for the guide. And they communicate through these headsets. Left, 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 a little bit more left, right, at 60 or 70 miles per hour.
You know, I want to stay on this
Can
topic.
Can you imagine going down a hill at 60 to 70 miles per hour, unable to see?
No.
I can't imagine going down a hill 60 to 70 miles an hour and being able to see.
No.
So, no, listen to this, though.
Neither can I.
This is just one piece from this New York Times story. Sean Halsted was left paralyzed from the waist at age 27 after a 40-foot fall from a helicopter during an Air Force search and rescue drill, and then said he did not feel like doing much initially. Here's the quote. My concept was, okay, legs don't work, so I'm not going outside anymore. I'm going to be on the internet. I'm going to be watching DVDs, because what else can you do? You don't think you can do anything else. And then they go on to say he's introduced the Paralympic sports at a VA winter sports clinic several years after his injury. By 2007, he's a national-level contender on the Nordic skiing team. It is just – these stories are – This New York Times piece is replete with stories of men and women who have made huge sacrifices for this country, who have moved on to be spectacular athletes. It's such a fabulous story.
I mean, it's the perfect combination, because you have these former soldiers who are already gung-ho to represent their country. They also have the discipline and the know-how to get through tough training cycles. So, and they're also physically fit in some respect. They understand how to physically do hard work. So it's this, you know, and they have the drive. So it's a perfect combination. And, you know, the Department of Defense and the Department of Veteran Affairs recognized this very quickly with the number of soldiers that were becoming home as amputees. And so not only do they have this winter sports clinic for disabled athletes, but the United States Olympic Committee has partnered with the Department of Defense and the Department of Veteran Affairs to introduce disabled sports as part of the rehab and recovery process.
Even if you're not Olympic caliber athlete.
Even if you're not Olympic caliber athlete, they figure this is a great way to boost spirits, to get these soldiers re-engaged in whether it's a team sport or an individual sport, and get them out of this mindset where I'll stay home and just, you know, be on the internet, and get them outside and doing something. So there's a real now cooperative effort between the United States Olympic Committee and a lot of these veterans organizations to introduce disabled veterans to a wide range of Paralympic sports. And out of this comes a large number of Paralympians, and I think we'll be seeing greater and greater numbers of Paralympians out of this. There are also athletes, though, who should not get ignored, with, you know, congenital birth defects, and who are amputees for other reasons, who are doing phenomenal jobs and running, you know, winning medals.
And we know, and I should know this, and I just don't. The Paralympics and the traditional Olympics were paired, not simultaneously, but sequentially, serially, whatever, in Sochi. Is that how it's been of late? Is essentially the traditional Olympics that we grew up with are followed by these Paralympics?
In recent, I don't know how far it goes back, but recently the tradition has been to take the Paralympics and stage those 2 to 3 weeks after the Olympics leave town. And as a result, it sort of started out as an afterthought. But now that you have some of these veterans competing and some really compelling stories coming out of these games, you know, I think NBC devoted 52 hours of coverage to the Paralympics this year, which was a new high. And I think that's only going to increase.
Are there crowds?
There are crowds. And For example, the gold medal final of the men's sled hockey, which the U.S. won over Russia, another U.S.-Russia duel, 1-0. And the winning goal was scored by a double amputee who was a retired Marine Corps sergeant, Josh Sweeney. But they played in front of a crowd of 7,000 at the Scheibe Arena, which was the smaller of the two arenas. But they said it was standing ovation, even for the Americans during the medal ceremony. The Russians stood and gave the Americans a standing ovation. And this is in the midst of all the Ukraine, Crimea politics.
Now, you may not know this, but do you know if any of these sledge hockey players for the United States had to crawl out a window of their hotel like you did while you're in Sochi, or do you not know
I do not know that, but it's interesting that you bring that
Why
up.
Why is that?
Because when we were there, they were installing the lifts for the Paralympic athletes out on our hotel staircases, and there was a lot of controversy that we could hear coming from people who were going to be there for the Olympics, officials who were going to be there for the Olympics and the Paralympics, and they were saying, this isn't how you do it. We need ramps. You can't have 50 people staying in a hotel complex and have them each individually go up one of those stair lifts.
Oh, God.
So I don't think there were any window exits, but I'm guessing there were some debacles with regard to entering and exiting.
We're talking to Shira Springer from the Boston Globe sports pages. We just had Ray Flynn leave. How many marathons did he tell you he ran?
31.
How many have you run?
Boston will be my 14th.
Are you running? You're running?
I am running.
Okay, well, that's perfect then. Obviously, it was announced, a week or so ago about what the police presence will be, what you can bring, what you can't bring. Summarize for us what the state of affairs is with the marathon that obviously is April 21st of this year.
Yeah, for runners, it's going to be quite interesting because it's a no-bags policy. While you can check bags at the Boston Common prior to the race, once you board that bus to Hopkinton to the start, you're not going to have any bags. You can take, I believe it's 1 liter bottles of water with you. Also disallowed are those camelbacks, which are the water containers that people wear that are backpacks. No backpacks, no bulky costumes, no flags, which are popular with military veterans who run the marathon. They typically run with holding aloft American flags. No strollers, no suitcases, things that are quite obvious, no bandits. They're strongly discouraging bandits from running this year.
I'm glad about that, actually.
But the main thing is the no bags, because what runners put in those bags are sort of their race day essentials.
Yep.
And they usually would check them in Hopkinton, and they'd be carted back to the finish line, and you'd pick up
extra clothing. Does that make it
difficult?
It does make life a little more difficult for you and your 30,000 colleagues, doesn't it?
It will make it difficult if there's any type of inclement weather. And by that I mean if the temperatures are too hot, if the temperatures are too cold, if there's rain, if there's wind, because you're not going to have perhaps as many extra layers as you might have had with a bag with you. You might not take as much liquid on a hot, if it's a hot day, you might not take as much liquid with you. So I think there are going to be a few hiccups here and there if the weather is not ideal. And
well, obviously, the clothes you wear, you're going to lose in Hopkinton.
You're going to take off, and they're going to go be donated to charity.
Yeah. So you're going to make sure you wear pants you don't care about.
Yeah, a lot of people go to buy cheap clothing and stuff like that. And I know a lot of runners who are investing in the small fanny packs that are allowable that you can take. So I think a lot of people will show up in Hopkinton with small stocked fanny packs.
I have to say that's appalling to me. No, okay. We can have a fanny pack discussion another day. Shira Springer, how about for people who are going to observe, and I'm assuming the crowds will be historic at this thing. What are the rules for them?
Again, no limited bags. I think there's going to be checkpoints where you're going to have to run through some sort of metal detectors at certain junctures. I think the closer you are to the finish, the more restricted those areas are going to be in terms of what you can bring on you.
And there's very little complaint. I'm assuming the vast majority of people are saying, listen, it's unfortunate, but the reality is it's got to.
Yeah. Evans, the police commissioner of Boston, William Evans, has said repeatedly that he wants to avoid the look of a police state. And although there are going to be a lot more police officers, the Herald's reporting 3,500 police officers planned this year, which is obviously many more than we've had previously. He doesn't want to have it look like an armed camp.
And by the way, Evans is somebody who cares about the marathon, considering he's run dozens of them. Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds reasonable. I mean, besides those hassles, it does sound reasonable to me.
And I think runners have become accustomed to dealing with these hassles since the Boston Marathon bombings last year.
Right.
Lots of races, big and small, have implemented tighter security. And as a result, runners are now sort of accustomed to dealing with metal detectors. I ran a race over the weekend in New York City. You had to pass
a half marathon.
A half marathon.
Good for you.
It was 31 degrees out, 18 mile per hour winds, and all of us are standing out there for 30 minutes waiting to pass through a metal detector to get to the start line. And nobody was grumbling. It was painful because it was freezing. But that's
okay,
Sheer,
if world. We want to root for you very quickly, what are you going to be wearing? Do you know yet?
Depends on the weather. But
okay.
I'll keep you updated.
Yeah, call in so we can cheer for you.
And let us know.
Good to see you, Shira.
Shira Springer, thanks for being with us. Shira Springer is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. As always, good training between now and the marathon, Shira Springer.
Warm weather, please.
Thank you, guys, for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We have the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, and a medical roundup with bioethicist Art Kaplan. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team is Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Will Roselip, and John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.